This is the first lecture of a four-part series on the prophecy of Ezekiel. The word Ezekiel means the one whom God makes strong. He had a prophet with him called Jeremiah. They were two prophets who lived about 600 years before the birth of Jesus, and they lived at a time when Jerusalem was on the verge of being destroyed. Jeremiah, for some years, had been prophesying the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the temple. This is because of certain things that the people of God were doing, which were not correct, and they were being chastised. We find that Ezekiel, he prophesied also about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, but specifically he was more interested in temple affairs than was Jeremiah. Now, both of them were priests. Both of them could go into the temple. Both of them could teach in the temple. But Ezekiel came along specifically to give God's instructions on what would happen to the people of God once the city of Jerusalem, and in particular the temple, would be destroyed. Because up to that time, the people always looked upon the temple as the house of God. That is, the place where God lived, where he had his domicile amongst men, where he would live symbolically and look out over his people and to judge them, to bless them, and to give them the things that they needed. They looked upon the temple as the house of God, and indeed that's exactly what it was. Now, the first discussion that we're going into here concerns that central purpose of the prophecy itself, which has to do with the temple. And it also shows God's role in the temple. And it's important for every one of us, even though we are Christians, to understand the premises behind what the temple stands for, because much of the New Testament teaching itself is based upon the principles that God lives within a temple. Now, he either lives symbolically in a tabernacle, a tent, like in the time of Moses, or he lived in a house made of stone, as in the time of Solomon, on down to the time of Ezekiel, and later on, even into the end of the time of Christ with Herod's temple. Or we find, too, that he lives in humans. He can live collectively in the ecclesia, all of us together, or he can be individually in each one of us, and that each of us happens to be a temple of God. To even understand how we fit into the pattern of things, it's good for us to realize what Ezekiel is talking about. Because they were on the verge, the Jews were, at that very time, along with the Israelites, of losing their temple. They were going to lose God's presence. They were not going to have God there anymore in the temple. What was to happen to them when this type of affair would take place? That is what we find Ezekiel writing about. He writes 48 chapters, the first 39 of them dealing with the temple that existed in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, in the 6th century B.C. And the other temple is his prophesied one, which he gives a description of in chapter 40 to 48. And it's a most marvelous section of the Bible on a brand new physical temple in which God will live. Ezekiel gives all of these things, and he does it in a way which makes even our New Testament understanding of God's presence with us much more comprehensible. It means that the temple, when you really look at it, was God's divine house on earth in a symbolic way. It was a replica of God's literal house or palace in which he lives in heaven. Now, you must understand the anthropomorphic way of approaching God and his bodily substance. We read in the first chapter of Genesis that mankind is made in the image of God. He is made in the likeness of God. God looks like man, or better yet, man looks like God. Now, there would be no need for a temple or for the type of furniture in a temple, for a throne to be in that temple, unless God appeared as a man. If we would accept some of the rational teaching that has been around for some time, that God does not have a body, that he is a spirit of some kind without substance, then the message of the temple is completely irrelevant and it means nothing. However, if we can approach the understanding of who God is, why he is our Father, who we are to become, and that he does have a somatic existence like you and I have at the present time, then we can begin to appreciate, and probably appreciate for the first time, just exactly what salvation is all about. Let me say here at the outset that we are designed by God the Father and by Christ Jesus, his firstborn son, to be members of the very family of God. We are to look like they are. We are to appear as they are. We are to have the character that they have. And eventually, we are going to have the power that they have, which they will share with us. Now, the temple is a part of this cardinal teaching of the somatic existence of God, which even the Jews today do not accept. For the last 1,000 years, practically, since the time of Maimonides, one of their great scholars of the 13th century, they themselves have given up the bodily existence of God, and they consider him to be some kind of a spiritual essence of some that has no somatic or substantial shape and form whatever. However, that is not what the early Jews, even of the Talmudic period, believed. Certainly not that of what they believed in the time of Jesus. And you will not find a word in the Old Testament which suggests for a moment that God does not have a literal spiritual body. Now, his body is made of spirit, but spiritual substance. It is not flesh, but it's still substance. Now, the reason this is important is because Ezekiel, in his 48 chapters, is talking about a house in which he lives. The house is called the temple. And we need to understand how God would exist among the Israelites when they are in exile from the land of Israel, when there is no Jerusalem, when there is no temple, and when they are, shall we say, without God amongst them. So Ezekiel is going to tell them what to prepare for. And you know, the teaching that we have here is applicable to each one of us today, because it helps us to understand how God can dwell among us, and more especially how he can dwell in us, if we read what Ezekiel has to say. Now, this temple was a replica, as I said before, of God's house in heaven, his palace in heaven. And in that palace in heaven, he had a place where he could put particular furniture, where he could sit, where he could eat, where he could drink, where he could have counsel with his administrative servants. And he does have servants. We find that when David, and under the orders of Samuel the prophet, were first designing the temple and also the administrators that would be with it, the priests and the Levites, as well as the singers and all of that, that they were divided into particular groups of people to be exactly analogous to the groups of angels and other types of spiritual beings in the heavens that happened to be God's administrative agents there, including the sons of God. We find that they divided the priests into 24 divisions. And in the New Testament, you're well aware of the 24 elders mentioned. They also had the 12 divisions of the tribes of Israel, and they were represented each month in the temple. And we find in the book of Revelation, the Israelitish tribes are mentioned there. And even when the New Jerusalem comes down out of heaven with its four-square shape, three of the tribes are going to be on one side represented, three on the other, three on the other, and three on the four. So we find even in the New Testament this symbolism of the temple very much in evidence. And that is what Ezekiel is dealing with here. Yes, we find that the temple is nothing more than a house, like you and I live in. There are only a few pieces of furniture that God does not need. He does not need a bed in which to sleep. That's the only thing about difference about his than ours. He does have a place to eat, because the altar on which the animal sacrifices were placed happens to be called the table of the Lord. He has a place to drink. And the wine offerings and other types of offerings that were placed on the altar were symbolic of God drinking along with eating at the very time of the meals that most people would have. Now, I know this may sound strange to some people who believe in the spiritual existence of God, but yet the temple itself has all of this furniture in it to be able to show that God has a home very much like we have today, with a few exceptions. And he has a throne. That is most important. He lives in a place which is completely dark, and is known as the dark place. And it was dark because God doesn't need light. He has the light himself. And from him emanates light, divine light, to such an extent that he doesn't need the sun, he doesn't need any other type of light to help him to exist. He is the light for all practical purposes, and he is the one who created the sun for each of us. He lives in what is known as the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum of the temple. Outside that inner sanctum of the temple, the Holy of Holies, you have a place called the priest house, or the holy place. There was an altar out there, the altar of incense. Now, in the Holy of Holies, I must say this, the only thing that you found in there were two cherubim, that is, plated with gold, with their wings stretched out, symbolic wings, that is, stretched out over a box. This box was had a covering on it, and it was typical of the throne of God, on which God would sit. And there his feet would be in front of this throne, and it would be his footstool. And often in the Bible we find that the word footstool simply means the place from whence God rules. The mercy seat, it's often called. It means the seat of covering, and the covering of all things, all of the sins of people and things of that nature, has a symbolic meaning to the whole thing there. But he faces eastward. In the temple, all of the doors into the temple are doors on the west side of the temple, so that God, when he sits down, he always orients himself. Notice the word orient means looking eastward. He looks eastward. And when the temple was set up in Jerusalem by Solomon, he placed the entrance to the Holy of Holies on the west side so that God, symbolically, when he would sit down, he would sit between the cherubim, and there he would rule, but he would always look eastward, and he would see his people. First of all, the court of the priest right outside, and then beyond that, and beyond the altar of burnt offering, which was outside the holy place, was another court called the court of the Israelites. And in the forepart of that court, facing God and closer to God, was the court of the men, and a little bit farther to the east, it's a much bigger section called the court of the women. Now, outside of the court of the women, you get outside of the sanctuary itself. Then they had what they called three camps. The camp of God, which was the camp of the priest, God, which was the Holy of Holies, the camp of the priest, or the Levites, and then the camp of the Israelites, who would camp around the temple, or as it was in Moses' day, they would camp around the tabernacle. And then outside that camp, directly to the east, they had another altar. And that altar is called the Altar of the Red Heifer. That altar was a major altar outside the camp, outside of the temple, outside of even Jerusalem. And that was directly east in the time when Herod was here. And they had up there an altar, and it was called the Miphkad altar, or the altar of the red heifer. And that's where all the unclean people could come. Unclean, no matter ritualistically unclean. And there they could obtain a view of God, God's home, his palace, and stand in front of God and pray to God, as he symbolically would look eastward toward all of them. Now, this red heifer altar in the time of Jesus was on the summit of the Mount of Olives. And isn't it interesting? Jesus was crucified outside the camp. He was crucified on the area outside the camp on the Mount of Olives, very near where the red heifer altar was. Actually, the greatest sin offering of all was that of Jesus, and the greatest sin offering in the temple that Ezekiel knew about, and Jeremiah knew about, and all the people of the first century knew about. The greatest of the sin altars was that one located on the Mount of Olives. And that's the fourth compartment, you might say, to the temple, though in actual fact it was outside the temple and was even outside the camp of Jerusalem. And that kind of an existence was there in the time of Moses. When they built the tabernacle, which was a portable temple, they had these three compartments to it, and they would then move the tabernacle from place to place. And for 40 years, God did not have any permanent home, as you all know, but he went from place to place. And while he was being taken from place to place, he was being carried by the Israelites. The main place where he was always looked on as being was in the Holy of Holies, or always sitting on that throne in which the cherubim had their wings stretched over, and that people would never see him. That's quite true. And only the high priest himself, only once in the year on the Day of Atonement, on Yom Kippur, in the autumn of the year, he would go in there at one time to get Israel completely cleansed of their sins. But he would not be able to go in unless he allowed the incense clouding, smoke from the incense, to cloud the whole area so that he himself, the high priest, would not be able to see that throne or that mercy seat on which God symbolically resided, or where he governed Israel. Now, all of this was typical. All of it's typical of what God's palace in heaven was all about. And since the time of Moses, the Israelites always had God dwelling in that tabernacle until the time of Solomon. And when Solomon came along, well, it was David, actually, who wanted to build a temple of God, but he was not able to do so because God wouldn't let him. But he did permit Solomon, his son, to build the temple. And what he did was to build a permanent temple made out of stone, gold, and other things. And he put in it these three compartments, the Holy of Holies, the Holy Place, and the court. And then he also put out on the Mount of Olives the red heifer altar. Everything was in there. Now, that existed until the time of Ezekiel here. But Ezekiel knew that that temple was going to be destroyed. Jeremiah knew that temple was going to be destroyed. And Ezekiel is writing these 40 chapters here primarily to teach the Israelites, the Jews at the time, what they were to be doing and how they would approach God once the temple was not there. Now, we don't have a temple in Jerusalem to this day, do we? That's true. So many of the applications that you find here in the prophecy of Ezekiel would apply not only to Jews today and to Israelites, but even in a symbolic sense to us who are Christians, and that we are the temple of God, and you'll know how he dwells in us when you realize how he dwelt in that temple symbolically back there in the time of Ezekiel. Now, the first chapter of Ezekiel, let's look at it now to begin with. This gives the general authority of Ezekiel to do the things that he was doing back there. He was a very high-positioned priest, though he was not high priest. He was very high in God's estimation, and he had to have a good deal of authority amongst the Jews as well as the Israelites. And God gave it to him by a series of visions that were vouched for by the elders of Israel themselves. But Ezekiel was given an experience, which was most important. That experience was to see God himself. That is, in a sense of not just the symbolic God in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, underneath the wings of the cherubim, but to experience with his own eyes and with his own body the power or the glory of God as it existed. And no one had ever seen this except in the time of Solomon, when the temple was first dedicated. We find that God came down, I'm going to show that in just a few minutes, with glory and greatness. And also when the tabernacle was commissioned back there in the time of Moses, we find that there was a manifestation of the Spirit at that time, of God in his glory. And even Moses was shown the back parts of God, as you will recall, in his glory. But that is a very unusual circumstance. But Ezekiel was given that. That is because he had power and authority to tell the Israelites and the Jews what was going to happen once God left this earth. He was going back to heaven. They were going to go into exile, and how he was going to treat them. So he starts out here by saying, now in verse 1, chapter 1, now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, and let me stop right there on that 30th year. That 30th year means Ezekiel's 30th year, when he became 30 years of age. This is important because, if you'll read in the scripture, when people were commissioned to the priesthood, they got their full manhood priesthood, so to speak, when they became 30 years of age. So, here he now had become 30. That means he was now capable of receiving divine instruction from God. And Ezekiel wants that to be known. Now remember, too, that Jesus himself, though he was not a priest, commenced his ministry when he was 30. So there are parallels to all of these things. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, I was amongst the captive by the river captives, that means the Jews and the Israelites. By the way, both of them were here. We'll see that in a few moments. By the river of Kebar. Now this is near Babylon. It's in Mesopotamia. And it said, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. So here comes the commission of Ezekiel, and it's rather impressive. Said, the word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel. Now, just not to somebody or a few people, but expressly to him. And the priest. And he did it in the land of the Chaldees by the river Kebar. And the hand of the Lord was there upon him, upon Ezekiel. Now notice this. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire unfolding itself. And a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. And out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. Now these were spiritual beings, these were angels, these were cherubim. But they had form and they had shape. And here we find Ezekiel saying that. I want you to notice, and this is important to remember, that he saw this whirlwind, this great white cloud of fire coming out of the north. Why the north? Do you recall that in Psalm 75, verse 6, promotion comes neither from the east, from the west, or the south? Promotion comes from the north. Why? Because God was looked upon as living in the north quarter of the sky. The north quarter in the northern hemisphere never moves, like Polaris, the north star. And indeed, in Isaiah 13, verse 14, it even speaks about the king of Babylon there, wanting to ascend to the north, to the sides of the north, where God was. And even James, our apostle, he spoke of God and of Christ Jesus, and Paul did too, as being continual in their existence, and they stay the same all the time, like the north star that does not move. So they had the idea that out of the north, or the north star, which does not move at all, was a symbol of the residence of God in heaven, and that he would come to this earth out of the north, and that is absolutely true. So, where does Ezekiel see this whirlwind coming from? From the north. That's to give a clue who was involved in all of this. Now he describes the cherubim here. They had four faces. One was like a man, one was like a lion, and one was like an ox, and the other was that of an eagle. These are also mentioned in the book of Revelation in the New Testament. You'll notice that all of these individuals here are the prime specimens of the living creatures that we have on earth. Man is supreme among all. The lion is supreme among the predators. The ox is supreme among the domestic animals, and the eagle is supreme amongst the fowls of the air. And it shows here that these creatures called cherubim, these angelic creatures, were in charge of all of the physical things here on earth, and that they were given these symbolic features in order to demonstrate that. These were the faces. But they also did one other thing. They were carrying something. I'm going to skip a lot right here. But you go on down, you'll find out what they were carrying. They were carrying something that had wheels, and wheels within wheels. Rather interesting when you look at it there. Some people have thought, well, this might be a description of a UFO or something. Lots of people have thought that. Well, I'll tell you this. It might be called an unidentified flying object, all right. But the only thing is, Ezekiel identified it. And so it's not unidentified. He identified it as the conveyance by which the cherubim carried something to this earth. And what did they carry to this earth? That is most important. You know, most people have just passed right over it, but Ezekiel doesn't even get to the place of what they were carrying until verse 26. And he says that here they set this down in front of him, this great power of this great brilliance, this conveyance and everything like that. And then he looked in what was being supported. Most interesting. It says, above the firmament, it is the expanse that was there, Above their heads was the likeness of a throne. Ah, a throne. Now get this. He saw a throne as the appearance of a sapphire stone. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above it. Appearance of a man. That's important to realize. Not the importance of a spirit that had no body. He looked like a man, and he was sitting on a throne. And the throne he was sitting on was made out of sapphire stone. I mean, a huge sapphire stone carved into the shape of a throne. And who's sitting on it? This appearance of a man. And he's there in all his splendor, and with lights, bright lights everywhere around. And he was just amazed, he said, and I saw the color of amber, the appearance of fire round about within it, even the appearance of his loins and upward, the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw with the appearance of fire, and it had the brightness round about, as the appearance of the rainbow that is in the cloud in the day of rain. So was the appearance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face and heard a voice of one that spake. So here we have the introduction to this wonderful book on the temple. He is showing it's coming from a person who sits on a throne, a sapphire stone throne, looks like a man, but has the resplendence of the sun. Turn over the cassette tape for the B section of this lecture.